This is the sixth day of this October 2012 seven-day session. And today we'll take up a koan. This is from the Mumon Khan, which means the gateless gate or the gateless barrier. And it's number 41, Bodhidharma and Mind Pacifying. 'Tis the season for Bodhidharma, where after Sesshin we'll be honoring him in our Bodhidharma Death Day ceremony, annual ceremony. So we'll just dive into the case. Each of these koans in the Mumon Khan has a case, a commentary, and a verse. And I'll start with just the case. Bodhidharma sat in Zazen facing the wall. The second patriarch-to-be, who had been standing there in the snow, cut off his arm and said, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace." Bodhidharma replied, "Bring your mind here, and I will set it at rest." The second patriarch said, "I have searched for that mind, but I cannot find it." Bodhidharma said, "Then I have put it to rest." So his Chinese name is Wei Ke. His full name is Da Zhu Wei Ke. And we know just little bits about his life. He's born in the year 487, which puts him 900 years before Basui. I'm reading here from Andy Ferguson's Zen's Chinese Heritage. He grew to be an imposing-looking individual with five bumps upon his head. We'll get back to that in a little bit later. He entered monastic life at the Dragon Gate Temple on Fragrant Mountain in Luoyang. It's the same area, of course, as Bodhidharma's cave. But first he practiced under a Zen master by the name of Bao Jing. Then Wei Ke met Bodhidharma and practiced with him at Shaolin Temple on Mount Song for 6 years. And that is what we will zoom in on in our koan today. But I'll keep reading here from the record. He's remembered and extolled in the Zen tradition for his determination to realize the great truth of the Zen school. I'll skip over his encounter with Bodhidharma and just move on here. After Bodhidharma's death, Wei Ke traveled to the capital city, Yedu, and he remained there, except for a period of political turmoil, for the next 40 years, upholding and expounding the practice of his teacher. These biographies are direct translations from the original, so there's a kind of a flair to the language that the translator preserved. However, religious rivalry and government persecution embroiled Wei Ke in the upheavals of his era. excuse me, this isn't the original that I'm reading now. This is sort of the introductory material. I'll mention when we get to the original material. At some time during this period, he sought refuge in the mountains. And according to tradition, he met and transmitted his Dharma to his disciple and Dharma heir, Sung San. Sung San is the author of Affirming Faith and Mind. Now, this is the translation from the original record. Before he had children, Wei Ko's father thought, "Our house pays reverence to what is good. How can we not have children? They often prayed to Buddha. One night they observed an unnatural light pervade their house, and as a result of this, Wei Ko's mother became pregnant. Because of this omen, when the child grew up, he was given the name Light. As a young man, Wei Ko showed uncommon conviction. He was very skilled at poetry, but was uninterested in household affairs, preferring to roam among mountains and rivers. Later, when he read the Buddhist sutras, he excelled in his understanding. He then went to Dragon Gate Monastery on Fragrant Mountain, where he began to train under Zen Master Bao Jing. He was ordained. He traveled to various seats of learning, studying the teachings of the Mahayana and the Theravada. At the age of 32, he returned to Fragrant Mountain, and there, it says, he practiced meditation throughout the day. Once while he sat there, an apparition appeared and said, "If you want to be successful, then why are you remaining here? The great way is not far away. Go south." So Wei Ke told his teacher, this Bao Jing, about this appearance, and the teacher looked at Wei Ke's head and saw that there were 7 bumps on it that stuck up like small peaks. I don't know how we got from 5 to 7, but it may have been at the hands of his teacher. No, no. His teacher said, "You have seen an auspicious omen. The evidence is here on your head. The apparition said that you should go south. This means that you should study with Bodhidharma at Shaolin Temple." And so Wei Ko set off for Shaolin. And then comes this encounter. And then afterward, when Bodhidharma completed his Dharma transmission to Wei Ko, Bodhidharma returned to India. I've never heard that before, but it may or may not be true historically. Again, this is the original record. A lot of these original records, they dug up on, these are carved into stone. Wei Ko then strongly expounded Bodhidharma's teaching and looked far and wide for a Dharma successor. So I'm going to skip over what little it says here about Wei Ko's relationship to his main disciple, Sung San. No, I won't, because it's worth hearing. It's about illness. So this Sung San, when he was still a layman, he came to Wei Ko and said, "My body has been racked by a terrible illness. I ask that you help me absolve the transgression I've committed that has caused this." Wei Ko said, "Bring to me the transgression you've committed and I'll absolve it." The layman said, I look for the transgression, but I can't find it. Wei Ke said, there, I've absolved your transgression. Now you should abide in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The layman said, seeing you here, I know what is meant by Sangha, but I still don't know what are called Buddha and Dharma. Wei Ke said, mind is Buddha. Mind is Dharma. Buddha and Dharma are not two different things. Along with Sangha, they comprise the three jewels. And the layman, Sangsan, said, today, for the first time, I realized that my transgression was not internal, was not external, and was not in between these two states. It was entirely within mind. Buddha and Dharma are not two things. So then Wei Ke recognized him as a great Dharma vessel. He shaved his head and gave him the name Sangsan. And that from that time on, his illness gradually subsided. Sangsan spent 2 years serving as Wei Ke's attendant, and then Wei Ke passed on the robe and the bowl to this Sangsan. And afterward, he said to him, you have received my teaching, and now you should live deep in the mountains. Don't circulate in the world, for the country will have a great calamity. And then after Wei Ke instructed Sangsan like in this manner, he went to Yedu and expounded the Dharma. His teaching spread widely, and as a result, a great number of people from all directions entered monastic life. He continued in this manner for 34 years, but then concealed himself and changed his appearance. Sometimes he would go to wine houses, sometimes to butcher shops, and sometimes he would mingle in the bustling lanes of the city. He was also found among the ranks of household servants. This is very much in the Zen tradition, at least the older Zen tradition, of after receiving the Dharma transmission, of sort of melting into the life of ordinary people in order to be exposed to a broader sampling of life and to learn to mix with all kinds of people and understand all kinds of people. And then some people were bothered by his Wei Ke doing these unorthodox things, and they said, the master is a person of the way. Why is he acting in this manner? But Wei Ke answered them, I have rectified my mind. Of what concern is this to you? And then in the next, I'll just sum it up. It sort of implies that Wei Ke got in trouble with the law. Some guy became, according to this account, some guy became jealous that Wei Ke was drawing more students, and he was angry and he slandered Wei Ke, and this left Wei Ke facing execution because of this criminal charge, but Wei Ke remained calmly composed. And then it says here in the old record, those who understand the truth said this episode was the payment of a debt. And then it says the master lived to the age of 107. All right, that's enough for biographical material on Wei Ke. And I'm going to not take the time to read about Bodhidharma. There's so much, and some of it I'll be probably recounting next week for our Bodhidharma Day. Besides, most of you, I wager, have heard pretty much the highlights of Bodhidharma's life, his meeting with the emperor, and then that brings us up here. So, back to the case. Bodhidharma sat in Zazen facing the wall. This became his hallmark and became the hallmark of the Zen school of Buddhism. Before this, Buddhism consisted of a great deal more scriptural study, doctrinal study, memorization of texts, chanting and a lot of rituals and ceremonies. And this is why Bodhidharma was considered something of a renegade by his simply sitting in Zazen facing the wall. For 9 years, we're told. And then in the case, we don't have this this story I'm going to read now, so I'm going to insert it in before we continue with the case. So he goes to, Wakug finds Bodhidharma sitting, his Bodhidharma sitting facing the wall. And now I'm going to read from the account in Roshi Kaplow's Zen Merging of East and West. In there he does a teisho on another koan, number one in the Blue Cliff record, Bodhidharma's I Don't Know. And in as part of this teisho, Roshi Kaplow includes this story of Wei Ke meeting Bodhidharma. And this is what Roshi writes from the various records. When Wei Ke first came to Bodhidharma, he was a well-known scholar, proud of his vast knowledge of Buddhism and the reputation it had earned him. Presenting himself to Bodhidharma, he stiffly asked for his teaching, but was ignored. He persisted. That's very important. Bodhidharma, sensing his conceit, offered no word of guidance or encouragement. He merely continued facing the wall in Zazen. At last, after a night in which the buffeted scholar had waited outside unmoving through a violent snowstorm, Bodhidharma saw him standing in snow up to his waist and asked, What do you seek? And then Wei Ke, his voice choked with tears, said, "My only desire is that the Master, out of his infinite compassion, open the treasure gate." To which Bodhidharma said, "The incomparable Dharma is realized only through long exertion at a practice difficult to practice and long endurance of that which is difficult to endure. Why should you, with your shallow mind and conceited heart, beg me for the true vehicle and suffer such hardships in vain?" This is another feature of the Zen tradition, is this teacher testing the student, rebuffing him, insulting him even, to see if he can persist, if he can brush off the challenge and prove his sincerity, to prove that it's not all about him and what he wants, but really what he needs more than anything in the world. And then, according to the story, Wei Ke to prove his sincerity, cut off his left arm at the elbow and laid it before the master. And at that, Bodhidharma agreed to accept him as a student. Now, I don't think there may be no one in the world of Zen, either a teacher or a scholar, who takes this story literally. It's a marvelous myth because it does what any great myth does. It conveys something of huge importance, a great truth. This is really what a myth, a great myth does. It's not just a story that's not true, but a story that's so profound that it can't be encompassed within mere fact. So we can derive from this story the real point of it, which is to attain the highest requires sacrifice. Most of us only want to give what we have to get what we want. I think that's true of almost everyone in Zen practice. It was certainly true for me, where, all right, I'll do yaza. I'll sit. Maybe I'll even sit during the breaks. Maybe I'll even do extra sitting in the week leading up to sesshin. And we do this, and maybe it doesn't bring the results we want. And so maybe we increase it because we do want results, and we still don't get the full results we want. And so maybe we increase it, and we may go so far as to simplify our lives, going into sesshin the week before, of cutting down on things. Another of the Zen ancestors put it very, very well. He said, the essential thing is to cut down on entanglements and concentrate wholly on comprehending the way. How many of us who go to sesshin and hope to realize our true nature can say honestly that we have cut down on entanglements and concentrated wholly on comprehending the way? This is where some honest self-examination can really take us to the next level. Because to come to awakening is the ultimate let's say just the ultimate. And how can we hope to reach this experience, this ultimate experience for any human being, to awaken to our true nature, to grasp through direct experience our essential mind and come to terms with birth and death? How can we expect to have this reach us without sacrifice, without giving something up, and maybe giving a lot up? Well, the real giving up, the real renunciation, is to renounce our thoughts, to give up even the thought of getting anything, even the thought of attaining awakening. This is a tremendous renunciation. But it is not disconnected from whatever ways that we find to simplify our lives between sesshins. We can't really have our cake and eat it too, at least not with real full-bodied enlightenment. We can't just avoid the sacrifice, the giving up, and still expect a great reward. I still have Roshi Kepel's words ringing in my ears, where he's giving a talk in during Sesshin, the Zendo, and saying that people don't want to exert themselves to the utmost because exertion, he said, exertion is painful. Of course it is. It's painful to go without sleep. It's painful to sit around the clock. And it may not be necessary to have a first tenuous glimpse into one's true nature. But certainly, the more that we are willing to forego in the realm of self-gratification and diversions and pleasures and all, the more that we can find as a way of simplifying our life, the more likely we are to be able to pierce this discriminating consciousness. That may not be necessary, but it's a measure of how important it is to us to realize this true self. There's a verse in the Mumon, a line from a verse in the Mumon Khan: "You must climb a mountain of swords with bare feet." For those of us who do enter the first gate, there comes a time when it's not even so much a sacrifice anymore. It's a need. We need to give it our all, everything, and stop holding back. Because we can't stand anymore not knowing. We can't stand it anymore. And then something far greater than this self takes over. We find a way. No matter how long we've felt stymied and at a loss of what more we can do, we find a way. It's a wonderful Japanese saying, if the bow is drawn hard enough, the arrow can pierce anything. All right, so after that night in the snowstorm and cutting off his arm, Bodhidharma stands before him, and Weko says, "Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace." Of course, no one else can give you peace. But Weko is desperate here. He probably knows that intellectually, that Bodhidharma is not going to wave a magic wand or do something that in another tradition they would attribute to the powers of a guru. He knows that Bodhidharma, he maybe even knows that Bodhidharma can't give him anything he doesn't already have. And yet, in his desperation, he doesn't know where to turn. He has to, at least, express his deepest longings. "I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace. Bodhidharma, bring your mind here, and I'll set it at rest." The second patriarch, Weko, "I have searched for that mind, but I cannot find it. I have searched for Mu, but I cannot find it. I have searched for this true self, but I've not found it yet." And then Bodhidharma, "Then I have put it to rest." The illogical nature of this exchange in the climax, where he says, "I have put it to rest," is what makes it a koan. And this is what the student has to demonstrate in Doksan, is his understanding of this, of what's really going on here. What is Weko doing here, separating his mind, what he calls his mind, as some kind of an object apart from him? Well, Bodhidharma plays along with it. "Okay, bring it here." "I searched, I can't find it." What is anyone doing who separates Mu, or the breath as apart from one, as an object outside oneself? It's so arbitrary when you think about it to designate a something as the mind. Who is apart from their own mind? And this is the power of words to perpetuate the illusion of separateness, of fragmentation. Okay, we come up with this word, mind, and there's surely one in every language, and then it becomes this entity, this thing. And then we believe that it is something apart from us. This is why in Zen it's always understood that words are not to be trusted, that the truth cannot be encompassed in words. Because they lie. They create the illusion of separateness where there is no such thing. And then Mumon's commentary, the broken-toothed old foreigner, Mumon is Chinese. His name is Wu Men. The Chinese certainly have their own way of seeing foreigners as real foreigners. And here Mumon is following the Zen tradition of bringing this great personage, Bodhidharma, bringing him down to our level, making him more accessible. Instead of idealizing and speaking in flowery language and glorifying Bodhidharma, listen to what he says. This broken-toothed old foreigner proudly came over 100,000 miles across the sea. This was raising waves where there is no wind. Bodhidharma could enlighten only one disciple, and he was a cripple at that. And then this line, hey, Shasanro did not know even four ideographs. Now this is an allusion to this. Shasanro is a nickname I learned for the first time this morning. Shasanro is a nickname for another Chinese master, Xuanzha, or Gensha is his Japanese name. This Xuanzha, or Gensha, was an illiterate fisherman before he got into Zen. And that, according to the story, he didn't even know the four characters written on a Chinese coin. So, hey, even the great Xuanzha didn't know the little that was on a coin. So Mumon here is playing around some, having a little fun. But this line, this was raising waves where there is no wind. Of course, this is exactly what Wei Ke is doing with his grasping at this, what he calls his mind. And Bodhidharma was able, through his skillful means, to show him that there is no wind, there never has been any wind. And then the verse, coming from the west and directly pointing, this great affair was caused by the transmission. The troublemaker who created the stir in Zen circles is, after all, you. Coming from the west and directly pointing again, referring to Bodhidharma, coming from India, directly pointing. How did he do that? How did Bodhidharma directly point to this mind? How are we directly pointing this week? And hopefully at home between sessions. This great affair was caused by the transmission. It's another point for the student to understand. And then Mumon takes one final swipe at Bodhidharma. The troublemaker who created the stir in Zen circles is, after all, you. Wait, is it Bodhidharma or is it us? Hard to keep it straight sometimes. The reason this legend of this dramatic encounter between Wei Ke and Bodhidharma, the reason it has lasted as long as it has, what is it now, 1600 years, more or less, is because of, again, because it dramatizes something that we know is still alive and very much thriving today and always will, this mind, this true mind of ours, and our search for it, our longing for it. But it is not just for the picking. It demands this kind of giving up the self, of course. And the self just means thoughts. That's all the self is. Thoughts, images, memories, associations, notions. They somehow, over the course of our lifetime, they've congealed together as we've accumulated all of our life experience, and they've come together into this aggregate that we call I, or me. How do we give up the self? How do we give up the ego? Through single-minded absorption in the practice. It's how we detach from thoughts. It's how we stop nourishing this self, growing it, glorifying it, defending it, preserving it. We don't even have to think in terms of giving up thoughts. We just have to be thoroughly absorbed in the practice. If we had to try to give up thoughts, we'd be in that same predicament of the story I said earlier about the man who, above all, had to not think of the red-faced monkey. No, we don't have to approach this negatively. We just have to pour ourselves no-mindedly, without reservations, without holding back, into this practice of the mu, the breath, whatever it is, without holding back. I'm going to close with words by the religious psychologist William James. This could have been written by Bodhidharma or Wei Ke. It is only by risking our persons from one hour to another that we live at all. Beyond the very extremity of fatigue and distress, we may find amounts of ease and power we never dreamed ourselves to own, sources of strength never taxed at all because we never pushed through the obstruction. There is still time in this session for each person to reach this state of complete self-forgetfulness. Plenty of time. How much time do you need to drop it all? Just merge with the practice. Not much time at all. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.